People are actually losing their homes and asking to rent in our apartments.
The biggest obstacle is, of course, lack of funds.
We think we've helped 58,000 people.
We're constantly having a greater demand for affordable housing.
Welcome to the Affordable Housing Podcast, brought to you by Eden Housing.
In our June 2012 episode, we spoke with Ken Marchingo, founder and CEO of Haven Home Safe, Australia's only vertically integrated affordable housing association and homelessness services provider. Ken had so much to say, and he said it so well that we were only able to cover half of the material we had planned to discuss. Hi, I'm Joanne Green, and on this episode of the Affordable Housing Podcast, we revisit the land down under. Who can get enough, right? To bring you part two of our interview with Ken Marchingo on affordable housing in Australia. Welcome back, Ken.
Thanks, Joanne. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
By way of reintroduction, Ken has worked in the community sector for over 30 years, and under his leadership, Haven has amassed a balance sheet value nearing $250 million and has generated more than $1 billion in economic activity across regional and rural communities in Australia. Let's start with a brief recap, if you will, Ken, of the overall situation in Australia when it comes to affordable housing.
Sure. Look, the situation in Australia is that we have a booming economy and we are bringing in skilled workers from all over the world. We've got a big immigration program and we just don't have enough houses. So it's quite different from the United States, where you guys have an oversupply of residential housing, and where you have an oversupply is often where you have an undersupply of employment. We have an undersupply of housing in most locations throughout Australia. And we particularly, within that generic undersupply of housing, we have a particular issue with housing that is affordable to people on low incomes. Because people on low incomes, on pensions, on benefits, people with limited skills, they're really being left behind in this booming economy, and their incomes are not enough to support the very high rental amounts that are a feature of our nation, where we have astronomical house prices.
So what is the two-speed economy of Australia, and how has this helped Australia avoid the global financial crisis?
Well, it's fairly simple. We, a bit like Canada in essence, we have a lot of minerals and things buried under the dirt that we can dig up and ship offshore, most particularly to China, which is, you know, as we all know now, the factory of the world. And these forward contracts that were in place when the world's economy melted down in 2008, by the time those forward contracts were ready to be renegotiated, our industries had, you know, had been going full tilt for that period of time, and the economic stimulus packages around the world had really begun to take effect. So there was a dip in Chinese exports to the rest of the world, but it picked up again fairly soon. So even though China is now moving at about an 8% per annum growth, down from 9 or 10% per annum, that's still a massive growth rate, and it is sucking up all of the materials that we can dig up, chop down, and ship offshore to them. So what that's done is it's created massive amounts of activity right throughout the Australian economy. And as our workforce has been absorbed in many cases into these new mining ventures, where there are literally billions upon billions of dollars of new infrastructure being put on the ground, we've been drawing in new immigrants from all over the world to replace, if you like, those workers who are shifting to the north and the western parts of Australia.
So really, mining's had a massive impact on the Australian landscape, literally and socially, right?
Absolutely. And the second speed really is everything else. So, of course, our manufacturing industry, similar to the United States, have trended down because we simply cannot compete with those developing countries. And so, you know, the challenge for all Western democracies is to work out how we skill up the rest of our population to compete in high technology and services industries. And Australia, like the United States, you know, we're not really geared for that, and we've got a long way to go in that area. But the end result is we end up with a two-speed economy, mining going full tilt, the rest of the economy, manufacturing, retail, and so forth, pretty much in what we call the doldrums. And, you know, there is great challenges for us, as there is with the United States, to see how we accommodate this new world order, in essence.
So the statistics are really quite amazing. The estimated housing gap, or the need, in 2008 was just under 100,000 homes, 99,500 homes. 2 years later, in 2010, it was estimated to be 202,400. To what do you attribute this?
Well, there's a couple of things, and something that's happened since we spoke last is our Australian Bureau of Statistics has realised that they actually overcounted some of the households, and so we think that there's probably a few hundred thousand households less in Australia than we actually thought there were, which is a classic piece of scientific engineering, I suppose. But the interesting thing is we think that the shortage, overall shortage of housing is still around about 235,000 in aggregate, but within that, we think that there's around about 500,000 to 600,000 houses missing that are at a rental level that is affordable for low-income earners. So in the generic undersupply, it's pitched more precisely and more pointedly at those people on very low incomes. And that is almost all in the eastern seaboard cities of Australia. So that's really where poverty bites hard.
Can you describe the Melbourne region for our listeners? What kind of housing do most people live in?
Sure. Most people live in 3 to 4 bedroom detached single story housing, which has in suburbs that just spread out from the CBD, gobbling up vast amounts of land. So Melbourne's about 3.5 or 4 million people, based on around a bay with some large sort of suburban areas that stretch out for, I'm just trying to convert to miles here, given that we think in kilometres, but probably stretch out 60 or 70 miles in most directions. And so these are just suburb after suburb. Now, recently, perhaps in the last two decades, people have moved more to much larger houses, so usually double-storey houses, 4-bedroom, 2 or 3 bathrooms, double car, garages, a large number with swimming pools in the back, big patios where you can put the world's largest barbecues, those sorts of things. So we've actually, over the last 2 decades, as a nation, managed to build what are currently some of the largest houses in the world, which is just in time for us to realise that energy costs are now going to double and triple over the next 10 years. And of course, those houses will become desperately unaffordable for people on modest incomes.
And let me guess, they're further and further away from the workplace.
So true. Same as in the United States, I suspect.
Absolutely. How does Haven fit into the spectrum of housing solutions?
Okay, so we're 160 kilometres from Melbourne, so or 100 mile out of Melbourne, in a regional area over the Great Divide, which is the geographic spine that runs down the east coast of Australia. So it'd be fair to say we're largely invisible to our policymakers who are clustered around the east coast. So we live. Haven is based in a town called Bendigo, which is a city of around about 100,000 people. It's an old gold mining town, and that it's experienced quite significant growth over the last 2 decades. So we've gone from a city of around about 50,000 to a town of a city now of perhaps 100,000 and growing. Our real estate is modestly priced compared to the rest of the state, but we're a town that had a significant decline in manufacturing in the 80s as Australia went full tilt on globalising. So we tore down our tariff barriers and chase what is laughingly referred to in Australia as the level playing field in economic trade. So what that meant was basically the destruction of many of our industries, which you also saw in the United States, I think, in the mid to late 80s and early 90s. So we had large amounts of poverty, large amounts of unemployment. So our role started back in the late 70s as a resource centre for people who were losing their homes or had nowhere to live. And we've now become, I think, one of the dominant housing players, certainly in Victoria, and I think it wouldn't be stretching the truth to say that we're reasonably well-known in our trade across the nation.
In Australia and Europe, groups like Haven work in what is referred to as the social housing sector. Does that mean that you provide public housing for your country? And if so, how are you a government entity?
No, we're not a government entity. We're an independent charity, but we are a company under the Companies Act in Australia, but a charity all the same. So we have a board of directors, but they don't personally profit from the organisation. And as a charity, what we do is we alleviate government of the burden of their cash wherever we can. So, our job is to take money from government wherever we can and apply that to providing services to people who are homeless or people in housing crisis. And most recently, in the last few years, we've been able to become what's called in Victoria a registered housing association. Now, a registered housing association is simply a vehicle, an independent vehicle, that can take cash from the government, leverage that cash with our own borrowings, and put housing on the ground. And the term registered simply means that myself and my management team and my board, we can't sell that housing off, take the proceeds and run to Buenos Aires with it. You know, it's protected in perpetuity for the poor and homeless and housing disadvantaged in our communities. But we've grown that housing stock from what was initially a small tender that we put out to build 100 houses in our general area, and we've now built more than 1,000 in the last few years.
It appears that the Australian government looks to Haven as a critical part of the solution for affordable housing in the country. Can you describe the relationship and how it came about?
Sure. The history of housing in Australia has predominantly been about home ownership, and about 70% of the population is pursuing home ownership. The other 30% of the population is generally rented. And government housing or public housing was initially really kicked into being after the Second World War. And it was predominantly about putting housing in locations where there was going to be was industry developing. So it was housing for workers. But over the next 30, 40 years, as industry patterns changed, industries moved offshore, industries co-located or moved to other areas, we were left with these vast housing estates where workers had moved on, and the housing really became welfare housing as we had a series of social revolutions wash across our nation, as indeed most Western democracies have, where we've seen women moving into the workforce, we've seen no-fault divorce happening, we've seen the rise of pensions and benefits for people who are on disability pensions, retirement pensions for the aged and so forth, and we've developed an economy that now seems to accept a large number of very poor people who cannot for one reason or another join the workforce. So that housing really became a repository for the poor. And as the need for housing for the poor has grown over the last 20 or 30 years, what we've seen is governments take what you would suggest on the surface are socially responsible positions of housing those in need first. So, you know, if you've got a kind of warm-hearted social work theory of the world, housing those in need first probably makes a lot of sense. But if you think about the fact that we've put all of those people in most need all together, it doesn't exactly predicate good outcomes for economies and neighbourhoods. So really what we do is, we rob the people in those big housing estates of aspiration, because we tend to have those housing estates in places where there are not jobs, where there are not good services, where there is not education. So public housing has really now become a failed experiment for the poor. So what the state's been doing in various states around Australia is looking to see what they can do to continue to house people responsibly, to see how they can withdraw from the direct provision of public housing. And one of the ways that they've done that is to try and identify the community housing providers, which is what we are, the charities who are in this game, and see among those housing organisations which ones are most likely to be able to thrive and drive growth. And I guess that's what Haven has become. That's half of our business. And we have worked with the government to take their money, to leverage up our own borrowings, and to extend our housing portfolio right across the state of Victoria now.
Ken, how does the Australian social housing sector compare to what we have here in the States?
Well, we're very small compared to what you guys do in the States, and that's a function of really small numbers. I mean, at the end of the day, the Australian population is about 23 million people, clustered predominantly on the eastern seaboard. Victoria has a population of about 5 million people, the vast majority of whom live in the capital city of Melbourne. And so our community housing sector is characterised by very, very small, and I might add good-hearted and incredibly committed, but very small entities, many of whom might manage 5 or 10 or 20 properties. They're very close to the ground in terms of being, you know, rooted into their communities and working closely with those people in need. But then amongst that group of around about 1,000 or more community housing providers around Australia, there's about 30 or 40 that have really grasped the nettle of growth and really driven their portfolios. And most of those organisations now run at about anywhere between 1,000 and 6,000 community housing units that are housing people in their respective communities. We're probably at the tail end of that league table, but we were traditionally not a long-term housing provider. Traditionally, we're a homelessness agency, and we work very closely with people who experience, you know, homelessness and have very high needs. So for us, moving into this space has been not only challenging and exciting and very, very useful, but it's created a whole range of issues for us too about who we house and do we fill up our housing portfolio with all of our homeless people, which, again, socially sounds like a really nice thing to do, but economically we'd be bankrupt in about 5 minutes. So we need to balance our portfolio, and that brings challenges to organisations like ours.
Of course. When you visited Eden Housing, you spoke about a study that was conducted that showed the cost of not building affordable housing. Can you tell us about this?
Yeah, there's been quite a few of these studies done around the world. The particular one that I was talking about at Eden Housing was one that was done in Australia recently that looked at the economic impacts of providing housing to people on low incomes. And by definition, it then begins to capture the cost of not housing people. So we know that when we house people who've been moving from place to place, unable to settle down, unable to get their kids into a school where those kids can stay at that school, begin to form some relationships, maybe join some sporting clubs, people start to get themselves some skills, they get known in the community, they begin to pick up some part-time work or move into full-time work. We know that a whole range of things happen. The first thing that happens is if people can get off state welfare, there's an obvious saving to the state there, but it's a saving that multiplies over the years. We know that then as people get into jobs, that the other benefits that flow to them become unnecessary. We know that we see people's health outcomes begin to improve, so there is a consequential reduction in numbers of the burden of healthcare and so forth. We have a universal healthcare system here now, which I think has been somewhat controversial in the United States of recent times, but you know, it's worked fabulously well, but it is expensive, and it is the sign, we think, of a good civil fair society. But when you have a universal healthcare system, if you get people into jobs, if you get them off welfare, you also see a reduction in the unit cost of that as well. So it's one of those things where if you take a holistic look at the real costs of welfare and the relatively minor costs of getting people into sustainable housing, which allows them to get into sustainable jobs, there are savings for everybody there.
Sure. I want to drill down on what Haven HomeSafe is. Can you give us a brief overview of the comprehensive programs that are offered and who the organization serves?
Sure. Well, I guess the first thing is we're in a town of 100,000 people. We see around about 55 people every day. And the majority of those people are coming in because they're about to fall out of accommodation. They have already fallen out of accommodation, or they're unable to find accommodation. So that is the primary activity is working with those people. So we have about 100 staff across a number of offices in regional Victoria, the majority of them here in Bendigo. We run, just to put it in context, around about a $20 million a year operating budget. Now, more than half of that is now coming from the rents that we derive. This year, we've had a $40 million capital budget, and we've produced 342 new properties. But more importantly, we've housed 312 new tenancies in the space of 1 year for us. So basically every working day and a bit more than that, we're housing a family, which is a tremendously gratifying thing for us. But what we try and do is not just run a housing service. Because we're a homelessness service, what we try and do is we try and stitch into the arrangements for those people a variety of supports that will help them stay in that housing. So we run a homeless case management program where we provide social workers, if you like, who work with those clients to try and identify what were the reasons that got them into the situation that they found themselves in, and how do we prevent that happening again. So that's a generic homelessness case management system. We also have some intensive case management initiatives that work with people who've got psychiatric illness, for example. And when we say intensive, we mean intensive. We've got one worker and they work with 10 clients. These are people who have very thorny social issues. But by working with these people, we keep them in housing. If we keep them in housing, we keep them out of the institutions. If we keep them out of the institutions, we're keeping them out of the acute healthcare system. If we're keeping them out of the acute healthcare system in institutions, for those 10 people just on that one case worker, we are saving the state hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. For a cost of perhaps $100,000 a year, we might save 10 times that. We have some programs, you know, specific programs that look at particular issues that people have. So, you know, we have a program that calls Supporting Families at Risk. That's about keeping families in public housing so they don't fall out. Again, if they fall out of public housing, they're probably not going to find private housing at a level that they can afford. They're going to bounce around the homelessness system using a whole range of sort of high-cost subsidies. So keeping people in housing is actually, you know, an economic no-brainer. We run a psych disability rehab support service where we keep people housed. We work with people who are coming out of the acute psychiatric system. We get them housed and we keep them housed. Again, preventing them falling back into that system. We work with people coming out of prison. So in the last 12 months, we've housed 22 prisoners who have, would be fair to say, have had long prison sentences. And in Australia, you've got to work pretty hard to get a long prison sentence. There's a reason why people spend a lot of time in our prison system. I think by many American states, our system would be seen as very generous, perhaps, in its sentencing. But these are people who, you know, there's reasons they went into prison, and when they come out, there's not a lot of support for them. So by getting those 22 people and working intensively with them and preventing them going back into prison, again, there's a saving for the state. But we've also worked with 450 prisoners who were going to leave various prisons on parole so that we can give them information to try and help them find somewhere stable, link them in with the services they need, and hopefully prevent that, you know, endemic recidivism that we see with people coming out of corrections. So what might be useful, Joan, is if I just run through our list of some of the programs that we run. We run an acquired brain injury support program, which works with people, as the name indicates, with acquired brain injuries to keep them housed, to keep them in their facility so that they don't create more cost to the state. We obviously run our affordable housing program, now more than 1,000 units around the state, where we provide people affordable accommodation where they can live there forever as long as they pay the rent and look after the place, and most of them do. We had bushfires that ran through Australia in 2009, killing 173 people in our state and wiping out some hundreds of houses in our town where those bushfires burnt to within 1 mile of the centre of our town. So we run a bushfire recovery project with many of those people for a couple of years. That's now finished, but that sadly happened just in time with the floods we had in 2011. So that kept those same workers busy working with people in floods. So we're not only, looking at providing specific services for specific niche target groups in our community. We see ourselves as very much a community organisation that is there to help, you know, the people in our community when these bad things happen, and certainly, you know, just as Australia is no stranger to natural disasters, neither is the United States, and particularly California. I think you'd understand the bushfire risk, that we have very similar issues there. We run a community connections program, which is an unusual program in that it's what's called an assertive outreach program. So most welfare organisations essentially wait for people to come to their door or wait for people to be referred to them. And with our community connections program, given that we're in a regional setting, we have a number of people who live in bush settings or beside rivers in fairly informal circumstances, we actively go out and find those people and see if we can reconnect them with the service system. They're very, very challenging work. We have a complex care needs program that provides 24-hour case management for people with quite serious intellectual or psychiatric needs.
And what is the concierge project?
Oh, now you've led me to one of my favourite things. The concierge model is simply something we run in our office in Bendigo, and it reflects the fact that, and I assume that this is probably the same in the United States, if I look at many of my peers and contemporaries, if I walk into their offices, I often find myself in an environment that seems to be characterised by bulletproof glass, people speaking through grills, some pretty untidy furniture that's bolted to the floor, not perhaps the most welcoming places to walk into. Now, I understand why many places who deal with chronic homelessness need to be like that, but we're in a regional centre. We sure, you know, we have the same people with the same needs, but we had the opportunity to build ourselves a state-of-the-art new office, and I didn't want to build an office that looked like a prison. And whilst I want my staff to be, you know, safe, and I have an obligation to make sure that that is the case, my feel was that the quickest way we could make our staff safe was to let all of our clients who walk in our door know that they're in the right place. So if we imagine ourselves as a homeless person And if you've never been homeless before, if you're not what we sometimes, you know, refer to people as frequent flyers of the system, if you don't know where to go and someone says, well, go to this place down the road there, when you walk in as a homeless person, there's a few things you don't know. The first thing is you don't know if the people you're walking into are going to help you. In fact, you probably don't even know if they care. You certainly don't know if they are going to be interested in you, and you really don't know what sort of reception you're going to get. And regardless of how homeless you are, you still need support, you still need help, and you're going to be desperate for that. So this is not a recipe for great relationships. So what I wanted to do was have a welcoming area so that when someone comes to our door, we see them before they get to our door, and we have one of our staff opening that door for them, welcoming them into our space, walking with them to our reception desk, which is an open reception desk, introducing them to our receptionist, letting them know that we're here to help them. And it's just that simple act of actually being on the other side of the reception counter, making people welcome. You're actually physically demonstrating that you're on their side in a sense. And in Australia, we've seen the demonisation of people on welfare over the last two decades as our economy and our politics, I'd venture, have moved more to the right. And it ain't sexy, and it never has been, to be poor. But when we have a society that does not value our citizens who are unable to compete in a marketplace, I think when we have all of our staff, not just our client service staff, but all of our staff, from the CEO to the payroll officer to the project managers to our accountants, our marketing directors, working in that concierge role, so all of us spend time down there in that concierge role, welcoming people into our place, letting them know that they're in the right place, demonstrating that we care, making them a cup of tea or a cup of coffee, giving their kids a biscuit or a drink, and making them as comfortable as we can. Even though we may not be able to help them, they can at least see that we're doing everything we can.
Well, you help them just by acknowledging their humanity. Many, many years ago, I remember interviewing a judge from San Diego, California, who wrote a book about homelessness when the word was brand new to many of us. This is like 20 years ago or something, 30 years ago. Yeah. And I remember him saying the most important thing you can do is look someone in the eye and acknowledge them as a human being.
That is absolutely so true. But the tangible output of this is essentially three things. The first thing is we are acknowledging people as a human being, and that's incredibly important. The second thing is every single person who works in my organization has direct exposure at least once a week.
So they know why they're doing what they're doing.
Absolutely. So what happens is, as we all do, we have people who manage multi-million dollar projects. They're very skilled individuals. They might not know much about homelessness. But when they're introduced to people in social settings, they don't say, I'm a project manager. They don't say, I'm an accountant. They can say, and with put their hand on their heart, and they say, I work with homeless people. And my people are proud to do that. And it gives a great culture to our organization. And what it means is it closes the rhetoric gap. And I think the challenge for all human services organizations is to close the rhetoric or the rhetoric, depending on what school you went to, I guess. But, you know, we all like to say what we do, but there's always a gap between what we say what we do and what we actually do. And I think anything we can do that closes that gap is a really important thing.
Haven Home Safe is a new name for your organization, which followed about 18 months of rapid growth and expansion across the state of Victoria. What happened that caused you to rebrand?
Well, we were originally called Bendigo Emergency Housing, and that was a name that I chose because it said what we did and where we did it, and there was an implicit challenge in that. If someone walks in my door in Bendigo and they need housing and they walk into a door called Bendigo Emergency Housing, you know, it's pretty clear what it is I need to do for them. But as our service grew across our region, which was called the Loddon Mallee region, that's based around a river and a large piece of desert, the Loddon River and the Mallee Desert, which are kind of features in our otherwise generally featureless environment. We called ourselves Loddon Mallee Housing because that was the area we moved in. But as we moved across the rest of Victoria, most people don't know what those names mean. So we wanted to create a name that said what we did without being geographically constrained. We wanted a name that kind of indicated that people would just be welcome. And Haven, you know, it's a good building. It's a good name. And so in our building, which we built recently, we share it with some accountants. And so when people walk in the wrong door, we occasionally say, well, no, you're looking for the tax haven, which probably will get me into trouble with them one day. But, Haven is a name that's very inclusive. We vox popped that around the place, and it was pretty clear that people just got that it meant home, that it meant safe, that it meant a place of refuge. So that was why we chose it, and it's worked really well for us.
Excellent. We're almost out of time, Ken, but I do want to ask you this. If you had a policy wish list that would really help improve the affordable housing gap in Australia, what would you put on the list?
Well, look, there's a few things, and I think one of the things that all Australians will tell you is that they pay too much tax, and I've yet to find a Western democratic country that will say that we don't pay enough tax, apart from perhaps the northern Scandinavian ones. But we pay very low rates of tax in Australia, and I think in America, you know, I've seen what some of your millionaires pay in tax, you know, is it 15 cents in the dollar and things like that.
Appalling.
It's disturbing. But I think, what you know, from a policy perspective, I think we've been in a race to the bottom in all Western democracies to see how little tax people can pay. Yet we still want freeways, we still want bridges, we still want hospitals, we still want services. And there's a fundamental economic case there that, you know, we all need to pay our share. I think, however, in terms of trying to focus on what's achievable rather than what's just a dream, what we need to do in Australia, at least, is to quarantine some of these silly tax provisions we have that bid up the pricing of existing housing and do nothing to increase new housing. I mean, one of the reasons we have an undersupply is we've managed to turn our existing housing into some of the most expensive in the world on any analysis, and yet we're not really creating new housing, and we've focused on building new housing for homeowners, but there's no institutional market in Australia for rental housing when we have, and this may come as a surprise, we're one of the smallest countries in the world in terms of population, we're one of the largest in terms of landmass, but we have one of the largest retirement income savings pools in the world. It is measured in trillions of dollars. Yet we won't, our rather silly investment laws here won't allow superannuation or pension fund money to be invested in these social good activities, which would return perhaps a 7% rate of return, but it would return it every year forever. And instead, we have this rather silly approach where people will invest on the share market chasing, you know, 10, 12, 15% returns and, in fact, get nothing. So I think there's a case for some policy action in that regard.
If people want to learn more about affordable housing in Australia and Haven in particular, where might we send them?
Well, all of the w's.haven.org.au. There's a couple of publications we have up there and a fair bit of information about what we do and some of the generic issues in Australia. Also, AHURI, A-H-U-R-I, Australian Housing Urban Research Institute, which I think is .edu. And that would be a great starting point. AHURI for the academically inclined, and certainly for the service provider inclined, Haven is a good place to start. Another place to go would be Power Housing Australia, one word, www.powerhousingaustralia.com, and that's an industry peak, a little bit like the Housing Partnership Network, which I think Eden is a member of in the United States.
Excellent. Ken, thanks so much for sharing your insights with us today.
Thanks for the opportunity, Joey.
Ken Marchingo, founder and CEO of Haven, Home Safe, Australia's only vertically integrated affordable housing association and homelessness services provider. And I'm Joanne Green. For more information and to access other episodes of the Affordable Housing Podcast, please visit edenhousing.org.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.